Welcome to the Week in IndyCar, presented by Cooper Tires on the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. Sitting here in lovely Romeoville, Illinois, in between rounds, just left the Mid-Ohio Verizon IndyCar Series event last weekend, won by Alexander Rossi, and staying over in the Midwest, heading to Road America for IMSA's round this coming weekend. So a little bit of a podcast capturing on the road. We're going to check in here momentarily with our friend Mike Hull, as the person I'm starting to just refer to as the Marshall Pruitt Podcast All-Star, since he has been a guest so frequently. But at the same time, the reason he is a guest so often is because we get so many folks saying, hey, this guy really does give us some great insight, some wonderful, whether it's knowledge, whether it's lessons, whether it's whatever it is, Mike's just become someone who really does bring a lot of intel, a lot of insight as to what goes down, whether it's during the race from a strategy standpoint, running a team, working with a driver of Scott Dixon's caliber, or in the past, so many others. So looking forward to having Mike here to talk about a race that I thought was just phenomenal, just ridiculous how good it was, and the fact that it required Alexander Rossi to put everything he has learned together in order to win, and also required a really, really brave and smart, brave, somewhere in between, maybe even a little bit of luck on the strategy side to pull that off, knowing that had it gone yellow at certain points, Rossi's two-stop strategy to the three that everyone else chose would have been blown. So just a really cool weekend for me to see the outcome be one that championed both driving excellence on the Indy 500 winner's part and also the team deciding to do something very different and to be rewarded for it. And you throw in the other stuff too of crowd size, and you know, I don't know what the number was. I can just tell you that driving in was definitely busy. Getting out was busy, and then just walking around, going around in a golf cart, even driving, as I did once or twice, to the infield. I mean, there's just people everywhere, and that's the kind of thing that you really hope for. It's not as if it's the first time or the 20th time we've seen that at Mid-Ohio, but you certainly go back there every year thinking, okay, how are we doing? Are there going to be fewer people here? Are there going to be more people here? What's the general pulse on the health of IndyCar? And it seemed like the numbers were up. I don't know, couldn't say if it was 1% or 5% or 10%, but it felt busier. And that to me was one of the many, many highlights. So we had some news come down today. We're talking here Tuesday night. It's about 9 o'clock here Central Time, 10 Eastern. We had news come down today that Mazda will be stepping away from their long-term sponsorship of the Road to Indy. Coincidentally, had planned a week or two ago when I knew I would be staying over, and the fact that I would be being local in Ohio and coming up towards through Illinois towards Milwaukee and then up to Fond du Lac where I'm staying for the IMSA event, knew that I would be passing by John Doonan's home, and so he and I spoke, and he said, hey, if you're staying over, you got to come over and have dinner with Kristen and the kids. So tonight, Tuesday night, was the night that was scheduled. Also turned out to be the evening of, or the day of, the announcement from Mazda that they were going to pull out from the Road to Indy. So we did our best to keep John in good spirits, knowing that he is really, truly the author of the idea, the architect of the idea, the father of this, you know, $2 million plus per year being handed out to the champions at each level, even the shootout below USF 2000 to get kids up to USF 2000. So a heavy night, heavy hearts there. And I hope Mike and I get a chance to talk about that a little bit. But, you know, for someone who created what has become and what is the global standard for a training series, multi-tier training series, really, really hope that IndyCar and Anderson Promotions, Dan Anderson, who has taken over and been running the Road to Indy since IndyCar passed it off and licensed it to his group, really hope that they're able to find a sponsor to step in and not just take Mazda's place, but at minimum, continue the good work they're doing. Just answer a few things here. I just got into the hotel, so I'll admit I haven't looked to see any of the updated questions, so there might be some about the new Road to Indy news from today. Did see some while I was driving, and I'll go ahead and tell you that it was at a stoplight, wink, wink. Some of the Twitter feeds and questions that came in, folks saying, so what does this mean for engines? To my knowledge, this just means that Mazda is no longer sponsoring the Road to Indy, meaning that $2 million a year, that is what will be going away once we get to start the 2019 season. Engines that are in all three tiers, to my knowledge, nothing is changing there, unless Anderson Promotions were to sign a deal with a different manufacturer and they decided that they had to have new engines, then that'd be a pretty tall order in such a short amount of time. So from a practical standpoint, I don't foresee any changes there going into 2019 on the engine front. And anyways, beyond that, we will have to see what happens, but definitely concerned. And we're at a place where with Indy Lights teetering a little bit on sustainability, I could not come at a worse time. So that's why for those of us who have invested so many years of our lives in either the Road to Indy or its many predecessors, concerned. Definitely going to bed concerned tonight, and will be until we hear about somebody that hopefully steps up. Maybe IndyCar. I wrote a little piece on Racer reaction to this, just saying that I really hope IndyCar, just to give folks a sense of confidence, will step up right away here and say, we'll get that graduation prize stuff handled right now. So next year, 2019, everyone's going to get what they have been getting that Mazda's been doing. And if we can find a sponsor to come in, then great. We can pass that off to them, but nobody worry. We want to make sure you know that if you come here and try to get to the IndyCar Series by investing in the Road to Indy and participating there, you'll have the same advancement prizes. So I'm hoping that's what we hear, that they are wanting to do and willing to do. Let's see, this is also the final. We're just a couple hours away from rolling over to August, so that means we are posting our final episode with support for the month of July from our friends at Justice Brothers and justicebrothers.com. So with that said, we'll be back in just a moment.
This month, the Marshall Pruitt Podcast is being supported by the Justice Brothers, whose line of additives, lubricants, and cleaners are America's brand for quality. The products are also used and proven by the world's top racing teams. So if you're interested in joining the sales and distribution team, Justice Brothers offers products for the automotive, semi-truck, agricultural, and industrial markets. To learn more, please check out their website at justicebrothers.com.
All right, so we are going to get Mr. Hull on the phone here, and I think, format-wise, we've got a lot of silly season things to delve into. Many of those things are pertaining to his team, his driver, Chip Ganassi Racing, even the second driver, Ed Jones. Had an interesting conversation with Ed before Mid-Ohio, just asking a general question of, hey, what are your thoughts for next year? And he had a great line of, I'm forgetting exactly how he phrased it, but basically, I'm unable to speak about that. And I think my reply was something along the lines of, is there another race car driver by the name of Ed Jones who could speak about what he might be doing next year? And anyways, he was convinced that I hung up on him afterwards, which wasn't true. But anyways, we had all kinds of fun in the paddock last weekend at Mid-Ohio. So not sure how many of the Scott Dixon, who's driving for what, is he going to be retained type things that Mike can or would even want to get into. That team is notoriously tight-lipped. So if you did send in questions, hey, Mike, is Scott going to be your driver next year? We might not even get to those because there are some other questions that I know he probably will answer that we might choose first. So, all right, I think we're also going to do something a little bit different format-wise here, where often, pretty much all the time, we spend the first whatever amount, 20 minutes, half an hour, analyzing something, what just took place. I think from the questions that I saw, by and large, cover most of the topics that we would get into on our own. So we're going to dial up Mike here and I think just go kind of sort of straight into questions as the format, since you guys have asked a bunch of great things, and we will use that as the wandering roadmap of how to get through the Mid-Ohio weekend and also some of this silly season fun here on the Week in IndyCar and the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. Mr. Hull, we are back for the 329th visit of yours to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast and the Week in IndyCar. Thank you for taking some time here on a Tuesday night. Boy, as someone who has spent many years of his life living in the world of race strategy, this sure was a fun weekend, at least for me to watch, knowing that it wasn't just driver skill involved. It was a lot of smart folks in the timing stand trying to figure out the right way to get to victory lane. What comes to mind from your end?
Well, first of all, you know, I thought a little bit about it before talking tonight. I think what we saw at Mid-Ohio wasn't necessarily just racecraft. I think what we saw at Mid-Ohio was perhaps the culmination or second coming of race teams organizing themselves with the mechanical advantage of the car in combination with the aero, maybe for perhaps the first time.
That's a good point.
I think it's taken race teams a while to understand that and get that right. And then what happened in Mid-Ohio, what we saw in the race was the separation that we've talked about that we thought was going to happen. The separation of the talent in combination with the new package for the very first time, not taking anything away from the guys throughout the field, because there was a lot of great racing going on.
Yeah.
But I think what we saw was the really talented drivers being matched up for the first time with teams finally figuring it out. And I think that's why we saw the racing as deep as we saw, not only at the front, but in the middle. I thought it was fantastic. I think the racing was fantastic. The number of people have emailed and texted me and called me for the last couple of days about how fantastic IndyCar racing is today because of what they watched. And the second thing that several comments I got, which I certainly didn't push, although I've been an advocate for a while, they said, guess what happened in Mid-Ohio? The pit lane was open the whole time. And we saw great racing. It didn't need to be artificial. Nobody got caught by a yellow flag. Not that I'm advocating for them to say, okay, let's just stop doing full course yellows and closing the pit lane and all that. But I think it proved the point that you can have good racing without closing the pit lane.
No, that's a great point.
Frankly, I hadn't thought about that until a guy named Mike Mokler, who I looked after, I don't know how many years ago, in Formula Ford racing in California, pointed that out to me. I think it was a great race there, and I think it's a directional pivoting point going forward for what we do in IndyCar racing.
You know, Mike, I feel like it's the perfect opportunity as well to mention two things. And, you know, you and I are friends with all of the folks I'm about to mention, and I also do some stuff with one of them on the Indy Lights broadcasts. But there have been times in the past where we have had a really great and compelling race where strategy was a big part of understanding how awesome what we were seeing happened to be. And maybe the broadcast talent on TV wasn't sharp enough or just wasn't paying attention to help draw everyone's attention to it and spell it out and plug people in, look at what's happening here. Same with the radio side. Radio product with IndyCar in the past certainly left a lot to be desired. Having listened to both IndyCar radio during the race and watched the broadcast, and then listened to our friends Lee Diffie, Townsend Bell, Paul Tracy, Kevin Lee, Katie Hargett, Robin Miller, and so on and so forth. And then on the IndyCar radio side with Mark James, with Jake, with Nick, Anders Krohn, they did and are doing a phenomenal job, Mike, of not just saying, hey, and there's a pass into turn such and such, but this is the strategy. Look for this. Ooh, this driver is pushing really hard now because it might pay off this way 30 laps from now. Or, oh, this driver looks like they're conserving a little bit because they're trying to do something sneaky to win at the end. Really have to give a lot of credit, genuine credit, to NBCSN and IndyCar Radio. And I would say Anders Krohn, his addition to the IndyCar Radio side has been transformative in that regard, so that whether you're watching or listening, you have some really sharp folks bringing the inside aspects of the race alive so you can fully appreciate what's taking place. So full credit to them for painting those portraits.
Well, you know, I obviously don't listen to the broadcast.
What?
I'm sorry to say I don't have time for that. But I've received the same comments. People have said the same thing. And they said there's more information now available than there used to be. And they also say, frankly, that they wish the television people had a better understanding and a better feel for how the races run from a race team perspective. But in fairness to that statement, I think those guys are under a lot of pressure because, you know, there's three of them bouncing off each other, plus the people in the pits.
And I think I left Jan Beekes out of that as well, so my apologies, Jan. He's also part of the team.
I think they do a really good job, but I think it's a snapshot of what actually happens, and then you have to be able to relay information to people that are hardcore, people that want to know why you pitted on lap 22, why you didn't pit till lap 30, and then you want people that want to be entertained. So I think it's a combination thereof for the television broadcast. But I think NBC Sports has really, really good people now working in the booth and really good people working in the pit lane. And I think as time goes on, that will come, the fruit will come to bear on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's do a couple of quick things and then dive straight into questions. We had our second ever live Marshall Pruitt podcast event. Did that at Mid-Ohio. You and a couple of our driver friends helped me kick off the very first one in June at Road America. The one last week at Mid-Ohio was a blast. Thank you for everybody who came out. Thanks to Cooper Tires for helping out there as well. Thanks to our friends at Toronto Motorsports. So a little bit of a fun story here, Mike. So we have the Week in IndyCar little cartoon logo that our friend Roger Warwick did for me. And also have the Week in Sports Cars one. And with Toronto Motorsports said, hey, can we do up some T-shirts? And I want to do some of each type, because I'm doing the live Week in IndyCar podcast event at Mid-Ohio. Then this coming weekend, I'm doing a live Week in Sports Cars. So I'd love to print some T-shirts and just have those to give away to everybody who's able to ask a question during those live events. And Derek Koska, my friend and the awesome guy who does all of that for us, says, great, I'll get those printed up and I'll bring them down with me from Toronto. He was planning to be here last weekend. So I get a call, the podcast was on Friday, Mike. I get a call from Derek Thursday night at about 7 or 8, just as I'm getting into my hotel. And he says, you'd never guess who's been stuck in U.S. Customs for the past 7 hours. And these stupid T-shirts of mine that I asked him to print. Yeah, let's just say that our this wasn't Canadian Customs, this was U.S. Customs, wanting to ensure only the finest people come across the border. We're wondering why this Canadian guy had a couple boxes of T-shirts with my ugly mug on them, and He had to go to extraordinary lengths and wasted a lot of time, but thanks to Derek, seriously, just one of the best guys for making all that happen, finally able to bring them across. And so we gave all those away at the IndyCar event, and we'll give the rest of them away this weekend in Elkhart. And as we do every week, Mike, as we start off Q&A, we pick my favorite question from the previous week to send that person a t-shirt. And our guest last week was the incomparable and mildly insane William Power of Toowoomba, Australia. And I happen to like Robbie Bergren's question of, hi Will, can you tell a favorite story from your dirt racing days? And thanks to Robbie, Will gave us some really awesome stuff there. So Robbie, drop me a little note here on Facebook, DM, something like that, and tell me what size t-shirt you would like of the new Weekend IndyCar style, and we'll get that off to you ASAP. All right, Mike, well, let's, as I mentioned, let's use the questions this week as the roadmap for our normal kind of post-event analysis and discussion. So let's see. I'm actually going to go right to the top here on Facebook. And, you know, you have to reward those who are actually the very first in line. You want to make sure that they don't get looked over. So we will start here. And this is actually looking ahead a little bit, Mike. This comes in from Sean Olmsted, who says, how much do you think the new front wing aero pieces added for Pocono will affect the cars? So from what you've seen of the minor additions to create some front downforce, if desired, Mike, do you think that's going to influence the quality of racing and maybe even tire longevity?
I think based on Texas and Indy law, the one thing that we saw it at Elkhart Lake too, in our case with Dixon toward the end of the race, it was really, really difficult at those three locations at the speeds we were traveling down the straightaways to get a run on somebody, and for the driver to feel comfortable to turn the front of the car to make a pass.
Yeah,
that's probably been one of the most difficult things with this aero kit, whereas everything else has been pretty good. So we're hoping that the additions for the aero pieces in the front of the car will help us to be able to make that pass more cleanly. Pocono is certainly very, very different. A very different racetrack in terms of the three respective corners there. Mechanically or technically more difficult. But hopefully it'll help us. That's the whole idea there.
Yeah, I think, Sean, there will be some improvement. IndyCar, if you look at what they did with, again, the modest allowances for adding downforce to the front of the cars, wasn't big. It wasn't some giant swing. So I would say the desire there was to create help without it being a massive change. So maybe if we're talking baby steps, 3 or 4 steps, not 10. Which would, well, that'd be fun. Dixon might like that. Dixon likes a really positive no, so Dixon might like 10 steps, but I think our boy is going to have to deal with 3 or 4. Let's move to Brian Smith's question, Mike, who is going to get us into the fun here of 2-stop or 3-stop strategy that dictated the outcome last weekend. Brian says, it seems like the 2-stop strategy was going to be dependent on getting some caution laps. When a race starts out clean like Mid-Ohio did, what kind of conversation happens about changing strategy, and how does it affect when you go from reds to blacks or vice versa?
I think, first of all, hats off to what Rossi and whoever calls his strategy there. I don't know. Actually,
Rob Edwards.
Yep. What they did there, they did a great job, and congratulations to them for that. The advantage Rossi had there to create a 2-stop strategy was he was out front. He had clean air for the most part. And so in clean air, you can set the tone for the lap, for the speed you're going to run. Everybody else behind you is fighting with each other And when you fight with each other, you use fuel. You don't save fuel. Rossi was out front saving fuel early on. And by doing that, he was able to make probably 4 miles to a gallon.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody else was probably making 3.4, 3.5 because they were beating on each other. And when you're beating on each other, you cannot save fuel. If you try to save fuel, they're going to knock you off the racetrack or you're going to back up. And so Rossi was in the catbird seat there with that deal. And nobody else was running at that pace without being stymied by somebody around them.
Yeah.
So what happened, I believe, with most everybody running from second backwards is they were already, their calculators were already buzzing trying to figure out when to stop to make it a three-stop strategy. You know, we scanned Rossi's channel, and toward the end of the race, they were telling him he was going to have to make 4.1 to get to the end. But he had such a lead that he slowed down and was able to do that.
Yeah.
I was surprised that he could drive the car all the way into victory lane.
Huh.
Even after he did that acrobatic act and stalled the car, they restarted him and he drove all the way around the racetrack. So either they were off on their fuel calculation, they got a big tank, or he was making fuel, one of those three things. Hats off to them for what they did. Matt Dixon, who normally makes fuel, we had a tough time getting to that number. So what you then do is you look at when you try to look at when you potentially, where your window is for three stops, where you're going to stop, and where that's going to put you onto the racetrack in relationship to traffic. Because when you leave the pit lane after the stop, you want to have 8 to 12, 14 laps without somebody in front of you, and you're going to go as fast as you can to try to make up that track position.
Yeah.
And it's either going to be on red or black tires, depending on what you choose, but that's what you want to do. And so I believe that's what most everybody else was trying to do to make up that gap. Wickens did the best job of that of anybody.
Oh, yeah. Now, he was on a tear there for a while.
He did. He did a great job of that. They did a good job of it. His car was right. Their strategy was good. But I don't think he was unusually different than anybody else. He just happened to be at the front of the stack. Then the second thing that happened there, probably people didn't catch on to it, but as those stops were happening, IndyCar timing and scoring went down.
Yeah. I did notice that.
So when that goes down, push to pass quits. So the guys that were coming out of the pits didn't have push to pass.
Wow.
So in Dixon's case, we came out right behind Rossi. We were trying to pass him with push to pass. Scott's pushing on the button like there's no tomorrow, and there's no push to pass. So I don't know what IndyCar is going to do about that, but they need to fix it. If their system goes down, they need to go to a secondary power station immediately, not wait for 3 or 4 laps to fix it. So that was a big problem for a lot of the people who were timing their stops to make up that track position. Because when you leave the pit lane after a stop, you don't use a push to pass to pass people. You use a push to pass on cold tires to make up track position. And that didn't happen for probably 5 or 6 of the leaders there that were trying to catch Rossi. That gave Rossi the race right there. That mistake gave Rossi the race.
Hmm.
So that happened. It probably was never picked up by the broadcast, never picked up by the radio people. So only the people in the pit lane realized what was going on.
Seems like somebody wanting to protect a lead or stop somebody from being able to catch up needs to figure out where to go pull that plug in the future. So,
yeah, maybe so. I don't know.
Look for an armed guard going forward.
Yeah, you don't have timing and scoring. You can't look at the intervals. You don't even know where your driver is on the racetrack in order to call him to the pit lane. In addition to all the rest of it, and you're getting a lot of great special words on the radio from your driver about the fact that he's pushing the button all the way through the steering wheel and nothing's happening.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yes. So that was a lot of fun.
Wow. All right. Let's see. So as I mentioned, we're not going to, you know, Mike being in such a senior role with Chip Ganassi Racing, as much as we would love for Mike to spill all the beans, tell us every single thing that's going on in terms of silly season, Scott Dixon, et cetera, et cetera. I know that I can ask Mike those questions, but we would be wasting your all's time because, he can't answer most of them, nor should he. So we're going to move on to most of the other questions. And if there's one or two in here that I can't ask on the general theme, maybe more of a personal opinion of Mike than maybe as a representative of the team, we'll see what we can squeak in. But trust me, I'm sure Mike wants to know just as much as you do as to how everything is going to look like next year. Let's see here. You know, Jerry Sudduth asks a question. And Jerry, thanks for coming out to the live podcast. It was great to meet you. You and I are spot on this. I was so wrong. Jerry says, I left the track on Saturday, figuring we would see a higher than usual amount of yellows on Sunday due to the unusual amount of offs and crashes during practice and qualifying. Yet on race day, the guys put on a great show, but there were no cautions whatsoever. What made the difference between the 2 days? That definitely piqued my interest. And my friend Anders Krohn, who I mentioned when we were done with the Indy Lights broadcast, we made a bet over for dinner, and he thought it was how many cautions there would be, two or more, or two or less, I should say, or three or more. I swore the bet was whether it was going to be a two-stop strategy or three-stop strategy that won the race, so we kind of agreed we weren't sure what we were betting on, so we're going to treat each other. I think I pay for drinks and he buys dinner, and he's Norwegian, so I'm probably going to lose out on that bet, Mike. But I went into the race the same way, Jerry, thinking, oh, man, this has just been a Dallara spare parts weekend, and the race is going to be a mess. Didn't happen. What do you think caused that, Mike? Any ideas?
I don't know. First of all, I think we thought the race was going to be like 2015. We thought there was going to be 14 or 15 laps of yellow. So we were taken back by what happened, just like I think everybody else was. What happened with race control in the practice sessions, and even in qualifying for that matter, was anytime anybody got sideways or spun, they called a full course yellow. Maybe they were frightened about the fact that there are a lot of blind corners there and they didn't wait to see if the car would restart or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, in the race, there were a couple of incidents where people did the same thing they did in practice and they didn't call a full course yellow. But people got their car going again, but they didn't. They waited on those guys in the race, but they didn't wait on them in practice. I think that was some of it. As to why it happened, I don't know. You know, if you could explain a lunar eclipse, maybe we'd understand why that happened in mid-Ohio. I don't have any idea. But, you know, as the race unfolded, we just work from the back end of the race to the front end of the race, and if yellow happens, it enlarges our window. I don't know. I don't know how to explain it.
Well, one thing that I think might be related, might be part of the answer, Jerry, is it was fairly warm Friday and Saturday. Not crazy hot, but I mean, it was certainly, you'd be sweating a little bit. Come Sunday, we had cloud cover for sure. Ambient temperature was down. Wasn't cold by any means, but ambient was down. We had cloud cover. I think the lower than expected track temps, which helped from a tire grip standpoint and tire longevity standpoint, I think that might have been one aspect to take into consideration, that I think on Friday and Saturday we might have had drivers on the edge a little bit more than they wanted, and also with that cooler, thicker air, maybe we're making a little bit more downforce. So it seemed like there were plenty of drivers on that edge Friday and Saturday, and it didn't look like that edge really came out as much come race day. So maybe that was part of it. All right, we got a great question here from Simon Spikert. What's the Mike Hole race morning routine? Drink a pot of coffee and crank Mark Knopfler's Speedway at Nazareth? Question mark. So, what's your race day like, Mike? What are your routines?
Well, in Mid Ohio, without a warm up, it takes forever for the day to get going, which is very unusual for all of us.
Didn't we go green at like 3:47 or some crazy? I mean, I got there at 9. Just as an FYI, I got there at 9 because I'm an idiot, but also recorded a bunch of podcasts, so that was fun. But it was a weird thing where like you could almost turn up at about 1 and you'd go get in a couple rounds of golf, I bet, if you wanted. So that was a weird day.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I didn't play golf. The our team guys, team people, didn't show up till like 10:30 on Sunday morning. So the cars didn't even come out of the truck for the fans. I was up at I stayed at the racetrack in the bus, and I was up at like at 7 o'clock in the morning, honestly. And I got up, I looked out, I went outside at 7 o'clock, and there were already tons of people there. And I'm thinking, man, we don't race till 3 o'clock. This is great. So there were people. I don't know what. In a way, I thought to myself, man, it's disappointing in a way, because most of these teams aren't going to come to the racetrack till 9, 10, 11 o'clock in the morning. The cars won't be out for them to see them. So I don't know. IndyCar needs to do something about that part of it. But for me, to answer the question, you know, I get up in the morning, have some breakfast. Frankly, wait for the people to our people to show up and then go to the truck. Get after our day. You know, there's a driver meeting, and then after that we have our what we call our race meeting, where we go over the things that we think are going to happen in the race and how we're going to deal with that. And then we get to go racing. After the race, here's the deal about Mid-Ohio, which I was amazed about. I knew the crowd was large. And I thought, man, this is the largest crowd we've seen here since the kart days.
Mm.
And so after the race is over, I go back to the trucks, the garage, talk to all the guys, walk up to the bus, and the guys up to the bus area, they were having a cookout, so I thought, well, you know, I'll eat a brat or something before I could drive home. And so I didn't get up to the bus for probably an hour after the race. And I looked out to the road out in the front there, and it was like taillights. It was bumper to bumper. I don't remember Mid-Ohio being like that for years. So I had a brat, figured I'll wait for the traffic to die down. 45 minutes later, I look up there, it's still bumper to bumper. It used to be in the kart days, we used to park our cars up by the road to get out of the place.
Yeah.
It took me 40 minutes to get to the road in front of the racetrack 2 hours after the race.
Wow.
I think that's great. When you have taillights for any kind of motor race, you know that it's a good race. You know that people are interested in what you do. And Green Savory are doing a great job promoting that race. They did a fantastic job with a selection of races in front of the IndyCar race on Sunday. And they had engaged fans. And we're seeing more and more and more of that now with IndyCar racing. It's like kind of like being on the front end of what happened for us in the 90s in the kart series,
yeah.
Frankly.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's really, really great.
I'm with you, and I was fortunate because Robin was feeling pretty sick even Saturday night. And he was going to try and go see a doctor, and you know, nothing critical, but just Robin wasn't feeling well by any stretch. And it was the same thing again Sunday morning. And so we said, hey, you know, he obviously has his TV obligations with NBCSN, but he said, look, as soon as I do my last hit on the broadcast, I'm out of here. So he and Steve Shunk,
okay.
Steve was doing the driving, but they piled out, and I think we're gone by lap 60 or 65 or something, because just to try and get Robin back so he could rest, he really didn't sleep. And so with Robin feeling ill, they were able to get out before the race ended, so they were very fortunate from that capacity. But it also meant that, and this was not a bad thing at all, but it meant that he and I usually, even when he's doing TV, he'll come up afterwards and he'll take a couple stories and whatnot. And with him being sick, he had to leave, so it meant I just stayed and did all the writing. We weren't able to do a video, obviously, but long story short, I wasn't ready to leave until about 8:15, and even though the race ended at 5:30 or whatever time it was, so I was fortunate, because by the time I was ready to go, it took me 1 minute to get out to the road. So there are some positives to staying late and working. So, Mike, you mentioned the support series and the great choices made there by the Green Savory folks who promote the event and own Mid-Ohio. Boy, we're accustomed to having World Challenge as the non-open wheel feature event during the weekend. They're kind of deciding to go down a different path where they headline all their events with the GT product. So what it left us with, Mike, was all three tiers of the Mazda Road to Indy plus the Mazda MX-5 Cup, and the MX-5 Cup might be the most fun racing series in North America. Those guys just beat the living heck out of each other, put on a whale of a show. The thing that I appreciated most, though, and this is, you know, coming back to our week in IndyCar theme, Pato O'Ward sweeps the weekend, both wins, Mike. He's now up 7-4 in the win column over Colton Herta. I know I've said this again in recent weeks on the show, but who would have predicted Pato O'Ward not just matching his more experienced Indy Lights teammate, but actually eking out a handy little lead with the championship winding down? You look at Pro Mazda with Holland's Rinus VK and also America's David Malukas doing more great work. And then in USF 2000, Kyle Kirkwood, another one of Jeremy Shaw's Team USA graduates who not only clinched the title, but won his 18 millionth race in a row. So despite the very sad news today about Mazda and their stepping away at the end of the season, boy, we saw a bunch of crazy young talent on display last weekend, Mike. I know you watched them closely as well.
Yeah, I do, and I don't know if I'm disappointed about Mazda or should celebrate what Mazda has done.
Yep.
You know, I think what happens is people have a tendency to, especially now with what goes on with not the internet but social media, it's all about these bursts of information that seem to be sometimes negative. When in fact, I think it should be more positive, but it probably will never be. Mazda is it 11 years that they've supported this program now?
Yeah, they came in 2009, and it was really became the formal thing that we've seen now in 2010. And before that, in Champ Car, with Champ Car Atlantic.
Yeah, I think they should be applauded for what they've done, because they've helped to architecturally build this ladder system to where it is today. And with Dan Anderson pushing it along now, I believe they'll find somebody to take up where Mazda has been and make it even better than it has been, because oftentimes what happens is there's that period of time where everybody freaks out, but then something comes along where they look at how it was done and they make it better. There's a lot of talent that's come through the system. You know, we've had three drivers that have driven for us that came out of the USA scholarship program. And there are drivers. Somebody told me that there was 20-some drivers that had raced in Indianapolis this year that came out of the ladder program.
Yep.
So I don't know what the actual number is, but I think that's a testament to how hard Mazda has worked to make the ladder work.
Well, think about, you have your two drivers are Indy Lights champions. Obviously, Dixie won his before Mazda got involved. But without that $1 million in Ed Jones' hand after winning the title in 2016 with Carlin Racing, I think that might have been the difference between Ed being a full-season rookie with Dale Coyne or a part-timer. So, you just look at all these options. And, you know, I think we're fairly well convinced, Mike, that Colton Herta is going to be an IndyCar driver next year, whether he wins the championship or not. But you look at a kid like Pato O'Ward. He's obviously leading the championship right now. If he goes on to win it, I know for a fact that that $1 million is the kind of thing that'll make the difference whether he goes forward or not. So it's just these kinds of things where you go, you know, we're not just giving you, hey, $25,000 for winning a race, congratulations. It's you can have a career, at least the head start on a career, and $12 million is what Mazda has spent on scholarships since 2010, and by the end of this year, it'll be 14 when they pay out for the all three champions in 2018. So it's just amazing. To me, it's just amazing. And gotta feel for that program going away, but also hope that someone will step in and realize there's great value in supporting, you know, our call it our NCAA type stars wanting to make it up to the big leagues. All right, let's move on to some more questions, Mr. Hall. We've got one here from Chuck Knob, who says, how close do Scott and Ed work together? He said Scott has had a Dixon-like season, while Ed has been pretty quiet overall. How close is Ed to turning things around? So two questions for you there.
I'll try to take those in the front order of the questions. Ed and Scott work together like the rest of our team work together, and that's unselfishly. First of all, they're in the same room after every time they run on the racetrack, whether it be at a private test, an open test, or a race weekend, any of those. They're also in the building together between races. So the drivers, Scott and Ed, the engineers, sit down and talk about what's going on, what they have in common, what they don't have in common. On a race weekend, they help each other read the racetrack, not only in the engineering office, but on the, when we're running a session. You know, Scott, in his case, with where I am on that stand, you know, Scott will say on the intercom, what's Ed doing? What did they do? How did they fix that problem? Where are they at on maybe the mechanical advantage of the car? Where are they at on aero? What just helped them to go faster? And vice versa, you know, on Ed's stand, they'll do the same thing. You know, they'll talk through the intercom to Barry Wanzer, and they'll say the same thing. You know, what's going on there? What are they doing over there on Dixon's stand? So they share unselfishly. That's no different than it's ever been for us at Chip Ganassi Racing. No matter who the pair of drivers were, or even when we had multiples of drivers, it was the same thing. Mm. Between sessions, when we had four drivers, they were all in the same room, the drivers and the engineers. So I think that that's the case. What was the second part of that question, Marshall?
Oh, was asking, excuse me, about Ed trying to turn things around. And, you know, he's remembering off the top of my head, I believe Ed has two podiums. So, I mean, that is certainly a good thing. But I also know that, you know, I think I don't remember, brother, I honestly kind of forget what I write at some stages or what I've said, so I apologize if I'm brain farting here, but either I've written it or said it in a podcast or something that, you know, one of the things that if I'm a team owner and I've got one driver who is leading the championship and going up against four cars from Andretti, three from Penske, and so on, if I got a teammate, boy, it sure would be awesome if they could help take points off of some of those that I'm battling against. And, you know, I mean, to one degree, Ed's a sophomore IndyCar driver. You know, he's not a fifth-year veteran. But, yeah, I think, you know, to the question, would have thought Ed might have been a little higher up than 13th in the standings right now. But do you think he might be at a place, Mike, where over these final four races, he might be a little more racy on race day?
Well, we hired him for that reason.
Yeah.
We see a lot of, we see quality there. We see potential there. We see ability there. And he certainly held his end. He's held up his end of the bargain. He's worked really, really hard for us. I don't know if I've been quoted on this or we've talked about this in the past with Ed, but what I like about Ed is he's all in.
Mm.
All he thinks about is racing.
Yeah.
It's all he wants to do. He works really, really hard at trying to improve himself, both in the car and away from the car. He spends an awful lot of time in our building with the guys working on the shop floor and the engineers. He tries to understand how we work on the product that he races. So he's very much into that. Dario works for us, as you probably are aware, as a driver mentor. And Ed and Dario spend a lot of time together. They walk the racetrack before the weekend starts. They talk about, Dario in particular, talks about every bump on the racetrack.
Oh, yeah.
Ed's like a sponge when it comes to that. So I have a high degree of respect for what Ed does and how he approaches it and what he accomplishes. And he's been a big supporter of what Scott Dixon has done and vice versa. And I don't think that you can be successful in racing without having teammates that are unselfish, and that's who Ed is.
Let's jump to some more questions here on Facebook. I love this one. This comes in from Jim Johnstone. Jim says, Jim says, fantasy time. If you could take a stab at breaking a track record anywhere you want, like Porsche's done with their 919 tribute car, what track do you choose? What car and engine do you take with you? And who is in the seat? Dixon? Montoya? Question mark.
Well, that's a loaded question.
Oh, yeah.
As soon as I answer that one, I'm going to either have... I'll have some people on my side and some people that think I'm the Antichrist. First of all, for me, it would be Indianapolis no matter what.
Okay.
That would be the short and for me the best answer. If we could go to Indy with a car that could break all the records, I would love to do that. And I think that's, you know, it could be possible if you had what, I don't know what Porsche is trying to achieve there, but I think it's great what they're achieving because they've decided to throw money at it in order to be able to set these records when in fact they walked away from sports car racing in that category.
And I think they might actually be generating more headlines from the record breaking than they did.
Ironic or not, but I love what they're doing. Because all of us that grew up in racing love the fact that people create technology to establish new speed records. It would be great if somebody would come along, if any of your viewers on this podcast would come along and say, "Hey, Mike, how about if I give you $4, $5, $6 million and you just build a car to go to Indianapolis to break the records?" We do it.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I keep looking for those kind of suckers
fantastic.
Every day. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And in terms of the driver part, to answer that question, Montoya or Dixon, you know what? Not only Montoya or Dixon or any other driver that's driven for us, any one of those with a car that was capable of breaking speed records would be our driver.
So here's a crazy thought I have, Mike. I think we could grab the Beast, the 1994 Penske Ilmor, bolt modern Firestones onto it, and with little more than that, maybe some slight downforce increase options, I think we go and destroy the record with the modern Firestones on that car. The idea that I have that I love is, and this is, since we're doing Fantasyland here, we will just say that drivers can't get hurt. I love the idea of Dixie and Montoya and saying, "All right, Dix, 4 laps, go get it. then pull him out of the car and say, come on, Montoya, you know you can do better than that. And then let Montoya do four, and then grab Dix and say, seriously, you can't do better than what Montoya just did? Seeing those two animals go after it, now that would be well worth the price of admission all by itself.
It certainly would.
Jim, thanks for that.
There's no question about that. That would be fun to watch.
Couple questions here from Ed Joris, Mike. One, which I think Ed asked in recent weeks, we didn't get to. Ed asks, why is the Honda branding on the Ganassi cars different from everyone else? So, A, did you know that? And B, is there an answer?
No, I can answer the question. It's a simple answer, frankly. At the beginning of the year, Honda needed to pick a location for the Honda branding. Because there was some difference of opinion from the individual IndyCar owners as to where it should be, because the engine cover isn't that large.
Yeah.
So they chose the fin as the primary location based on the feedback from some of the owners. Well, our owner said, wait a minute. Honda is a big partner of ours.
Yeah.
They've been a big help to us over the years, not only in this series, but in previous series of racing. Why shouldn't we give them more exposure? So our Honda is on the engine cover in the way it's displayed because of that. You know, you have an option as to where you want to display it, and that's how our team has chosen to do it.
And that, I have to admit, I was wondering if it was just either a contractual thing or a styling thing, and that
is contractually and styling, we the case, we just stick it on the fin.
Hmm.
But our owner decided, you know what, we could just stick it on the fin, but that's not the right thing to do.
Well, take that, everybody else. It's on the engine cover. And can I just comment that Ed Jones' car in the DC Solar livery, now that's a beautiful thing. That is truly a beautiful thing. So props to whomever did the livery on the Ed Jones Hot Rod, because that car was looking all kinds of beautiful last weekend. In and around the green grass and trees at Mid-Ohio. All right, let's grab a few more here, then we'll take a look at Twitter, and then I think we will start to ramp down, Mr. Hull. Keith Lee, thank you for sending this in. Keith says, hey, Mike, in honor of Morris Nunn, who we just lost, unfortunately, can you give us a couple of great stories about him and his time over at Chip Ganassi Racing?
I'll give you one story. First of all, I would say about Morris, for me personally, I worked with him at Patrick Racing, and then subsequently worked with him at Chip Ganassi Racing. So I worked with him in two different locations. He was such a great mentor for me personally. I learned so much from him. He was such a contrarian.
Mm.
You know, he didn't always come up with or the expected answer that you would think would happen. He decided to wanted to solve problems in a way that would be different than everybody else, because he knew if he did it correctly, that you would beat everybody else like a drum. So that's kind of how he looked at it. Secondly, he understood, because he was a driver, and he understood what a driver needed. That some engineers have never driven race cars. So the book of engineering knowledge tells them how to solve a problem, but it doesn't tell them how to solve a problem in a way that the driver will appreciate.
And that's what was so good about Morris, was the fact that he knew what the driver actually needed. So he used the engineering background from the people around him to solve problems. That was really, really terrific. We were having dinner with a race driver that can remain nameless at the moment. At a point in time when we were getting ready to choose a driver going forward for a new race season. And he said to Chip, let's take him to dinner. So we went to dinner, and we had a great dinner. And after the dinner was over, and we had interviewed a couple of drivers in the process besides this driver, he said, that's my guy. That's the guy I want.
Really?
And Chip said, why is that? He said, because that driver has alligator arms. He said, what do you mean? Chip said, what do you mean? He said, he didn't want to pay for dinner. He said, that's my guy. Any guy that, any driver that doesn't want to pay for dinner is the guy that I want to hire.
How crazy.
That's a small, that's crazy, but it's a small thing about Morris. You know, he never looked at the obvious. He always looked at he looked at things that totally different, and I think he made such an impact on all of us at Chip Ganassi Racing for such a long time, and a lot architecturally, a lot of the culture that we have today was defined by him. He helped direct us. You know, there was a whole group of us there at the beginning. He was one of them. And we pushed each other along, but from very different backgrounds. And the culmination of all of that made us who we are today. And he was certainly a big part of that. And I was quoted of this a while ago, but when somebody asked me about Morris, but oftentimes when I'm perplexed, I'll stop and the way I'll look at it, I'll think sometimes, well, what would Morris do? Especially when I get bombarded by all the people within our structure who are all part of groupthink. That's what he was so good at. He was so good at arming himself against groupthink. And I have a great degree of appreciation for that.
Amen. Sad to see Morris leave this world behind, but as you mentioned, there are some folks who do whatever they do, leave, and you can point to the things they did for themselves as maybe their greatest achievements in life. Morris is one of those types where you say, look at how he made things better with those he worked with, whether it was ideas, processes, you name it. You think, when I think of Morris at least, it's, wow, he left a lot behind that enriched other people, and that's, that is the way to go. Got a couple questions here, Mike, that are kind of on the silly season-ish angle, so I'll try and shape them in a way you might be able to answer them. One was coming in from David Zitterbart, our friend from Australia, asking about kind of sort of not exactly countrymen, but someone just a wee bit south, one Brendan Hartley, saying, hey, it's no secret that Brendan's had questions about the security of his seat in Formula One. And he was curious that if Brendan were to be on the open market, is he someone that Ganassi might look at again? And keep in mind, he's not asking about, you know, Dixon or Ed or anything, but who knows? If a third car materialized, would someone like Brendan still be on the proverbial short list if you could get a hold of him?
Well, I think Brendan Hartley represents the kind of driver that anyone should be interested in having drive their car. I think the reality of what goes on in motor racing today is that, unfortunately, a lot of people try to rationalize talent with how much money drivers are bringing. And Brendan Hartley doesn't represent that.
No.
He represents the talent side of what's important for
what should be a big time IndyCar owner's passion, drives their passion and their aspiration to move forward. So yes, Brendan is the kind of driver that you want to have drive your race car, whether it be where he presently is with Toro Rosso, or whether it be in any car racing with a present owner, whether it be in sports car racing where he was before. I mean, he was a big driver of what happened with the success of the Porsche in
the WEC, yeah,
in the WEC series, you know. So I know they wanted him to stay on there to drive their Formula E program, which is coming next. So I think that if you looked at him and to answer the question from Australia, I think that's the kind of driver that you want to have driving your car. And if you're not in a position as an owner where the driver hires you, then that is the person, that is the kind of race driver you want to have.
And I think, David, from what I know about Brendan, he and I know each other a little bit. I'm not claiming like we're,
okay,
like great pals, but, you know, as someone who also covers sports cars and Brendan, you know, from the start of the Porsche program to the end, looking at what's been happening in F1, I think, David, that Brendan is the type of driver who thrives where extreme pressure and instability is not present. So obviously, if you're representing Porsche, you're already under a lot of pressure. So I'm not saying that isn't something he's accustomed to. He just strikes me as someone that, personality-wise, actually, he's a lot like Dixon, mellow guy, good-hearted, funny, warm guy. You know, a positive person as well. He doesn't strike me as the type to really thrive if there's just a lot of turmoil going on. It seems like every day, am I going to have a job? I think, and again, this is just throwing in 2 cents from, you know, getting to know him a little bit. If I'm thinking of Brendan in an IndyCar team like a Ganassi, like a Penske, a team where stability, you know, the personnel, same guys have been working on that car in the team for decades, I think if Brendan were inserted to that kind of scenario, and Andretti as well, I think the guy flourishes. Because with everything just kind of comfy and ready for him to just do his thing, and in a warm and positive environment, I mean, heck, look at Wickens. Look at what he has done in a warm, positive environment. Alexander Rossi coming over as well. Prime example of someone who is... Holy cow, no one knew how talented he was until he got to Andretti and could show it. I think Brendan, in a high-quality IndyCar team that is stable and just says, hey, kid, go drive the wheels off the car and have fun, I think that kid's a nightmare for other people to solve. So I'd love to see it, David. Don't know if it will, but I would absolutely love to see it. Let's jump through a couple other quick ones here, Mike, and then we're going to bid farewell to this episode. Justin Lee says, as a member of the media and as a member of a team, between you and I, would you prefer a race that is nonstop passing through the entire field, or a race where the drivers are at the limit setting fast laps, but there are minimal passing opportunities? What do you think most drivers prefer? Well, Justin, to be honest, that to me sounds a lot like the difference between a Saturday and a Sunday at an IndyCar event, because the nothing but fast laps, that's the awesome part about the Firestone Fast 12, Fast 6, you name it. Come race day, I know it can be very rewarding for drivers who come back and say, man, I just had to do 90 qualifying laps start to finish, but I, you know... How's this? Only one person can be on pole position, and everyone else is going home not happy that they aren't on pole. So I think if we're looking from a driver's perspective, somebody qualifying fourth is not going to want to come home at the end of the race and say, boy, that was satisfying. I did a whole bunch of qualifying laps, but I was fourth. They're going to want to say, I moved forward until I was first. So I think for the most part, what attracts people to the racing, not the qualifying, not the practicing, but the actual competition that matters during an event. We want to see passing, you know, we want to see touchdowns, we want to see slam dunks. That to me, that's the exciting stuff. It's also where things go wrong and drama comes in because one guy hit the other and so on and so forth. I mean, Sebastian Bourdais, our mutual friend, Mike, good Lord, he had his own race on Sunday. We have a question here about the blue flags and some drivers being grumpy about, you know, quote, back markers not getting out of the way. I know a French guy who started dead last after goofing up qualifying, and it's not as if people just moved out of his way every single time on Sunday. That guy showed that he was going straight to the front and drove his way there, so that's also part of the fun, Justin. So I think if most people had to pick in the paddock, they would say, yeah, we do the fast laps in qualifying. Let's go do some passing on Sunday.
I think it's important for race drivers to understand in a particular race, not necessarily Mid-Ohio. We saw that at Mid-Ohio with what you referenced there was the lapped cars. Lap guys are racing with lap guys, and they're fighting really hard for that one position, and that's no different than the drivers that are lapping them that are fighting for that one position.
Yeah.
But I think that you have to be able to understand the reality of where you are in that race and the fact that it could turn around a race or two from that race. And if you display a certain amount of courtesy without giving up too much track position and the roles were reversed, you would appreciate the help.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't think that it should necessarily be a clear path for somebody to race to the front, because it's part of the race. That's the way it works. And but there's a difference between, let's say, there's a difference. You know, after the race is over, a driver that's racing for a middle pack position that's a lap down and is racing with somebody else, and if after the race they look you in the eye and they say, you know, I raced today against Scott Dixon or Will Power or Alexander Rossi. What are you supposed to say? Are you supposed to say, yes, you did? Or are you supposed to say, no, you were in the same race? And that's what I'm referencing. If the roles were reversed, let's say we go to Pocono in a few weeks, and one of those drivers that was racing for position a lap down is suddenly one of the lead cars, and one of the people that they were that was trying to get around them is suddenly in front of them to get around, for them to get around, how's it going to work?
Yeah.
So I think it's really, really important for there to be some amount of courtesy and some amount of understanding from each of those drivers as to where their station is on that particular day and the courtesy that they need to display in the process.
And I'll add to this topic, Mike, before we move on to one or two more to close out. I completely understand why Robert Wickens is so frustrated that there were, you know, some folks that he was coming up to lap or otherwise folks that were not in contention for a quality finish. I understand why he would be very frustrated that some of those folks fought so hard, caused him to lose time. He thought after the race he could have chased down and caught Rossi, who was 12-ish seconds ahead at the finish line. I think that might have been a little optimistic, but regardless. But I think there's maybe one thing that was overlooked here, and I wouldn't expect Robert or others who complained.
Just say something about that comment?
Yeah.
He was on a three-stop strategy. He was paying the price for being on a three-stop strategy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he can complain about people he's trying to get around. But if his team would have chosen a two-stop strategy, then that would be a different conversation.
No, very true. Very true.
So I think you need to put that in perspective when you start calling people out.
Well, here's the other thing that just stood out to me as well, Mike, and I realize it's a bigger picture thing. It's not something a race driver is really going to think about in the car while it's happening. Robert Wickens is on something like a 5-year contract with Schmidt-Peterson Motorsports.
Okay. Well, that's great.
Congratulations. Newgarden, and I'm not saying that all these drivers complained about, you know, traffic slowing them down, but Newgarden's on a multi-year, this driver, that driver. Some of the folks, this might sound like a cop-out, but it truly isn't. The guy that, you know, you're whatever position, you're running third or fourth and really trying to make this three-stop strategy work, and there's some a-hole in 13th place and the guy behind him in 14th, and they're going tooth and nail and really not making it easy for you to go by and lap them. Well, there might be a little something more to it. If this was Long Beach, Mike, or Barber, third or fourth race of the year, and folks are putting up that kind of fight there, I'd say no question, call them out 100%. When we're getting to this stage of the season, Mike, some of the cats who are running 12th, 13th, 14th, even though those positions aren't that great, they're fighting to keep their drive. They're doing all that 13th place, whatever. And again, I'm just, it's a random number, but being able to fight your balls off and come home 11th or 12th to prove to the team that was probably telling you beforehand, hey, man, that 17th and the 15th before that, that's really not doing much for us. If you want to be here next year, show us something. There are some folks who, even though they're having bad days and potentially being lapped, they might have a slightly different mission, which is good for you and your quest for the podium. I'm trying to keep my damn job, so no, I'm not pulling over for you. So, again, just there might be some different motivations going on here. None of them evil, just different priorities based on how some races are playing out for certain people. Let's grab one or two more, Mike, and then say farewell to our episode. Grab this one from James Lidicote. Says, with the breaking news about Mazda leaving the road to Indy, there's already a lot of comments on Racer.com about how IndyCar teams should be required to run in Indy Lights. Wouldn't that just hurt the smaller IndyCar teams that are struggling to get or stay full-time? What would Mike suggest could be done for the ladder system to keep it healthy? And I'll kind of roll in a couple other questions here, Mike, about this Road to Indy announcement with Mazda. Does IndyCar need to focus on rebuilding Indy Lights, retool it from the ground up, etc.? Should Honda come in and take it over from Mazda? And, I'll just interject a couple things here. We had a great thing for IndyCar happen this year, which we've mentioned, which is Carlin Racing came up with a 2-car IndyCar team. Well, what did it take for that to happen? Erasing 3 to 4 full-time Indy Lights cars, taking that entire crew and shifting them up to IndyCar. So there's a huge Indy Lights team gone. Juncos Racing, which had been multi-car, well, now they're kind of sort of full-time with one entry. They have come down to one. We've had a number of teams, a number of drivers jump up to Indy Lights. So all that happening coming in for 2018 has caused us to have a fairly small number of cars. But that isn't the problem. There isn't a problem in Indy Lights because we have a small car count. The problem is we've had both a lot of teams and drivers move up to IndyCar and deplete those seats. The real problem has been cost. The cost to operate, it has just been too high. There'll be more news on an initiative here to reduce those numbers, but I think it's important, Mike, to separate Mazda's choice to step away and problems with the road to Indy. they are not linked together, at least as I see them. And for some of the suggestions of, well, should Honda come in? You know, I've heard for a while that Honda has an interest, but it's primarily an interest in providing engines, not providing scholarship and advancements.
Right.
That would be a problem. To me, the biggest thing that the Mazda Road to Indy needs is, when Mazda goes away, is for a, pick whatever it is, some sort of non-automotive brand to step in and say, hey, we want to support this. But, you know, Indy Lights, that annual budget is going to have to come down 30 to 40%. IndyCar is going to need to get further involved, and possibly on the financial level as well, to stabilize things right away. You know, there's a lot of things going on here, just all at the wrong time, unfortunately. But at least for what you've seen, Mike, coming back to James' question, what do you think might need to be done, either big picture or granular, to add health to the ladder?
Well, number one, the announcement by Mazda publicly today, it was today, I think.
Yep.
Shouldn't have been a surprise to the people that make decisions. This didn't just happen. So IndyCar and Dan Anderson's program, his Dan Anderson Promotions, I think it's called.
Yep, Anderson Promotions.
Anderson Promotions. There had to be some kind of option or something in the agreement or something that went on that must have been exercised or voiced some time ago, number one. It didn't just happen on the 31st of July. So the people that make the decisions had to know about this 30, 60, 90 days ago, I'm guessing. That's only a guess on my part.
Yeah, I think it was actually a lot sooner than that. But
okay, so I don't know, because I'm not privy to that. But my thought is this. When that comes at you, you're already working on what you have to do next. People like you and me, Marshall, we just find out about it when it's announced, unless, well, like you probably know about it before I do. But it still comes, you know, these people should... Dan and his group and IndyCar have to already be working on a commercial sponsor or a OEM or someone to come in and take up the slack. That's number one. Number two, a lot of the drivers that have come into the Indy Lights series and also the Pro Mazda series have come with foreign funds. They've come because their currency works well with the exchange rate. If you go back to the Indy Lights series, when Kanaan, Helio, and some of the others like those guys came into the Indy Lights series, it was because their reals bought more in Indy Lights than it bought in Formula 3000.
Yep.
So I think you also have to look at that. It isn't just the series itself creating the foundation, it's where the money comes from. You have to follow the money. And lots of these drivers, like those drivers, are funded when they come, no matter what it costs. I don't know why we only have 7 Indy Lights cars on the grid presently. Frankly, that's dismal. I don't know why IndyCar doesn't take a bigger step in correcting that, because it's called Indy Lights. We only have 7 cars on the grid in Indy Lights.
Yeah.
Why isn't somebody in the IndyCar series looking at that more seriously? So whatever it takes to make that series whole again needs to happen. Hopefully they're doing that. I was at the USA scholarship thing, the other night at Mid-Ohio. Sat next to Dan Anderson and talked to him for quite a while about it. And he does have a plan. He's got a plan in motion. He's working on it really, really hard. I know that. And hopefully with what he's doing, it will drive more people into the highest tier of the ladder system, mm-hmm. which needs to happen. And he has such passion for young drivers and what they can do and what they can accomplish that I think it can happen. And I think Dan's the driver of the whole thing, and I think he'll drive IndyCar hard to make it happen.
Couple more questions here, Mike, and we're going to close out looking at Twitter. This one you and I haven't had a chance to chop up a little bit, so it'll be really interesting to hear. I spent some time catching up with little fire starter Connecticut Santino Ferrucci last weekend. Was mildly mortified by the social media mob mentality towards the kid, as if, you know, you're 20 years old and you have some pretty big screw-ups all contained in one weekend. There are a lot of folks who believe that the rest of life's opportunity should be taken away from you. Kind of a pious thing, if you ask me. But Sean, at Sean Stern, asks, what is the likelihood Ferrucci can actually buy a ride? And he said, the kid seems radioactive to any sponsors, and the team that signs him would lose support from fans based on the comments I've seen. I can't really think, Mike, of a Chip Ganassi Racing driver other than Eddie Cheever who is more disliked than Ferrucci. A little bit of humor there. Hope you're listening, Eddie. I can't really think of any Ganassi drivers who've, you know, been, quote, radioactive either to sponsors or fans. But if we're thinking of this young kid, again, 20 years old, said a bunch of stupid things, did a bunch of stupid things all over the Silverstone F2 weekend, basically had one giant F-up during that event. What comes to mind, Mike, in terms of either career resuscitation? Would someone like Ferrucci, if they hadn't kind of made amends with the world, is that someone that you think teams like yours and others would want to touch based on reputation? So what comes to mind with this kid?
It's interesting. If a driver did on a cool-off lap in NASCAR what he did,
they'd get out of the car and fight afterwards, and NASCAR clap.
If you knocked a guy off the racetrack on your cool-off lap in NASCAR, you're applauded. I don't know what caused the problem there, nor do I truly know. Even I read what you're talking about. I don't know the depth of what actually happened there.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, at this point, I don't know that it makes a difference. I think what makes a difference in IndyCar racing and what sponsors really care about is, first of all, what you do on the racetrack, and then secondly, what you do when you're out of the race car, how you represent them and how you represent the team owner and the team itself. I thought he did a really good job when he raced for Dale Coyne at Detroit.
Yeah.
And we only saw that in America. We only saw that from a very young race driver. We saw Detroit's not easy. It's not an easy place. And I thought he did a really good job there. I thought he held his own well there. I thought the team did a good job for him there. I think that's what we want to see. I think the American mindset, the American fan base, is willing to accept drivers that can get it done on the racetrack and give them some amount of flexibility out of the race car. I don't know why it is that an American Formula One team would give up on an American driver. That bothers me.
Yeah.
Nor do I understand why they wouldn't have another American driver driving on their Formula One team. So that's probably just a personal opinion.
Yeah.
Maybe it has nothing to do with the fact that he's no longer driving in Formula Two and he's been released from an American Formula One team as an American. and why he wasn't replaced in their ladder system with another American. That bothers me.
Yeah.
So I think they should look at themselves in the eye and figure that one out. So that's beside the point, I suppose. But
no, and Sean,
let's find out what he can do in somebody's race car in America.
Yeah, and Sean, I'll add this. We had a similar situation, not identical, but similar situation just a couple of years ago in sports cars where Tommy Dreese, a veteran among veterans, been around forever, had a huge meltdown at, I believe it was the Mid-Ohio Trans Am finale.
Right. Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
Hitting and trying to take out the Amy Ruman, who went on to win the championship, saying this, yeah. I mean, truly made a giant ass out of himself. Again, kind of ticking almost all the boxes here. Dangerous on-track behavior and this, that, and the other off-track. And that was in Trans Am. They banned him for a year, and, you know, they dropped the hammer, as they should. Well, that's Trans Am. Tommy wanted to race in IMSA shortly after that. I don't remember what event. And was granted, you know, had an IMSA license and was allowed to race. And I am fairly confident that I don't think it would happen in the first driver's meeting. Probably a private meeting with the IMSA officials, Mike, but I'm fairly sure they pulled him aside and said, look, what you did in Trans Am under SCCA sanction and the ban that they placed on you, well, we're not SCCA. We're a completely different organization. What you did wasn't here. It wasn't under our sanction. But if you pull anything like that, forget a year ban, you are never going to compete in our series. I can fairly well assume that is what took place. Point being, if this kid wants to come race an IndyCar, I can think of no reason why IndyCar or its teams shouldn't or wouldn't allow that or embrace the idea. But I think they should make it clear that, look, the stuff you did in Formula 2, if we see any hint of that, you're gone.
Well, wait a minute here. If what one of you, I don't remember which journalist, I don't remember which article I wrote and who it was written by. I know it wasn't you. They made a point that Ferrucci was only there because he had an enormous amount of money.
Yeah.
Well, if that's the case, there will be an owner in IndyCar that will take him on.
Sure.
Okay, but I think that he did prove his worth at Detroit. He deserves an opportunity somewhere, whether it be in IndyCar or whether it be in some other form of motorsports. And at 20 years old, guess what? There's a lot of time to mature. And if he has the ability to back it up, you can wait on the maturity.
And I would also just add to close on this and move to our last question. The texting while in the car, I'm just saying that if Santino wants to prove that he has learned from his very recent mistakes, this happened this month, Mike. I mean, granted, we're, you know, an hour away. We're almost at August 1st here. But, you know, if you want to show remorse, and not just remorse, but show that, okay, maybe I can actually spend some time trying to do something good for others to turn this around, you know, whether it is some sort of don't text while driving, advocacy, volunteerism, there's a lot of things that people can do when they make a giant ass out of themselves to either pay back in some way, shape, or form, if we're talking karma or something else. Look, if you want to try and give folks an impression that you're not the D-bag that you came across as, a lot of ways to do that. Whether you come out of pocket and donate, whether you go volunteer, whether you plant trees to improve the environment, I'm just saying, you can save the whales, you can go and feed folks at a homeless shelter. There's so many things you can try and do just to show folks character rehabilitation that you get it. That was the worst side of me. Let me try and show you and myself that I can be a better person. I think beyond whatever amount of money the kid might have to bring to a team, he would be wise to maybe think about engaging in some actions that might show he's not just living for himself. All right, off of that topic, let's close on one that
you know,
I am...
You know what he got to do too, Marshall, by the way?
Yeah.
A lot of young Americans... as race drivers wanted to be able to do what he got to do.
Mm.
And that was to race in the European system.
Yeah.
And to race in that system, is totally different than what we do in the United States.
Yeah.
It's very hardcore. It's very much you're on your own. It's very much, I don't really care who my teammate is. It's a very, very different system. It's not a do-over system like you have in America. I get what happened because of the system that they have there. I applaud him for the fact that he got to race over there. It's something a lot of young American drivers would love to do and have never or may never get the opportunity to do. And we have drivers in IndyCar racing today, American drivers, that have driven in that system, and I would be willing to bet if you ask them about it, they would tell you how important that was in their educational process as a race driver.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm going to say thanks to John Sable, who sent in a great comment here, counter-argument, saying how he likes how everyone battles for every piece of track in IndyCar, whether it's those who are about to be lapped or otherwise, says he hates seeing how lap cars and F1 just dive out of the way, says it looks a bit artificial. I'm more on your team on that one, John. Let's close with a question that tugs at a little bit of heartstrings here. There's a post this morning from someone you and I both love dearly, that being Julia Wilson. Saw that post on Instagram that today would have been the big man, Justin Wilson's 40th birthday. So Merrick Speed, at Merrick Speed, said, "What's a..." And I've spoken or written far too much on the topic. What's a memory Mike has of Justin Wilson? And he did drive for Chip Ganassi Racing. Some might not recall that. It wasn't in IndyCar. It was in sports cars. But whether it was when he drove for you or not, what can you share a memory of the big man on what would have been his 40th birthday?
First of all, he did drive for us at Daytona in the 24-hour race. And my first memory was when he came to the building to be, I guess you could call it, fit in the car. He didn't fit in the car. You know, most drivers say, okay, let's get the fitting going. Well, it was an unfitting because he didn't fit. But, you know, he got in the car somehow. That was a Daytona prototype car. He got in the car somehow, I don't know how, and said he didn't want anything changed.
Huh.
He would drive the car the way his teammates drove the car. And, I mean, he was like, his legs were into the steering wheel. His feet were not in the right places. His arms that were, because of his size, his stature, were like folded up on the steering wheel. It looked to me like his head was going to go through the roof of the car. All the things that shouldn't be right that most race drivers would totally complain about and would say, I'm not getting back in the car until it's right. This guy got in the car, got out of the car and said, it's perfect.
Wow.
Realizing that, you know, he's got a 5'4" teammate as one of the three or four guys that are driving the car. Never complained about anything in the car. And when his time came to drive the car, he was one of the fastest people in the car, in spite of the fact that I don't know how he did it physically. That was my first recollection, or my first go with Justin up close and personal. When he won at Texas, considering at the time who he was racing for, not taking anything away from Dale's team today, because I think they're a far cry today, so much better than they were then.
Nothing like they are today.
I think that everybody in the paddock stopped and said to him, congratulations for that reason. And he deserved it so much because of how he represented himself, who he was, and the fact that he wanted it more than anybody else did. He was a very, very special person. And truly missed. Because in the car and out of the car, he was the same person. And hard to find, really hard to find.
Mr. Hull, thank you as always for taking some time. I think we have set a new record for the latest recording of the Weekend in the Car, presented by Cooper Tires, and also thank
well,
you.
Well, people don't see the timestamp, Marshall. They don't realize what time we're talking tonight, so we're okay with that.
You know, I'm 12 sheets to the wind before we got started, so... thanks again to Cooper Tires, obviously. They've been just an amazing partner this year, helping to grow this little podcast of mine. To our friends at Justice Brothers, who jumped in here to be an associate sponsor for the month of July. Also to our great friends at TorontoMotorsports.com. Please visit their site, because they've got some pretty cool shirts, stickers, you name it. They're just... they're one of the only kind of memorabilia slash fun type businesses that aren't just supporting IndyCar, but actually coming out to the paddock, being a part of what we're doing. And it's also just fun to see the new little cartoon characters they pick for each IndyCar round. So anyways, TorontoMotorsports.com, some good folks there. And to our friend Mr. Hull from ChipGanassiRacing.com. Heck, we'll call you a member of the media. That's what it is. You stopped by from a website to talk. Well, Mike, you know how much we appreciate your constant support here, what we do, and I look forward to seeing you in a couple days, 2 weekends
in
a row.
Yeah, we'll see you around America for the IMSA race. You know, we do double duty, Marshall.
Yeah, I know.
And it's what we do. We race, so it's good.
Amen. Well, thanks again, sir, and... we will be back to you all next week.